60 acres. It wasn't clear whether that meant 2,520 acres for a man and wife. In California, with 1,260 acres and subsidized water costing between $3.50 and $9 per acre foot, a halfway ambitious farmer could become a millionaire, which was not exactly the intention of the Reclamation Act. And then, on top of everything else, there was Tellico Dam. Tellico was a dam the Tennessee Valley Authority had conceived as early as the 1930s and hadn't gotten around to proposing seriously until the 1960s, which was mute testimony to the kind of project it was. The dam itself would produce no power. It would merely raise and divert the Little Tennessee River about a mile from its confluence with the main Tennessee, so some extra water could be run through the turbines of nearby Fort Loudoun Dam. The result would be 23 megawatts of new power, about 2% of the capacity of one of the nuclear and coal plants the TVA was simultaneously building. There were no flood control benefits. There were hardly recreational benefits. The region had more reservoirs than it knew how to fill with boats. There were no fish and wildlife benefits. On the other hand, the Little Tennessee was about the last fast-flowing cold water stream in the state. It was dammed only once upriver, while most tributaries of the Tennessee were dammed several times. It had a large and healthy population of trout. It was a splendid canoeing stream. It flowed through a beautiful valley, one of those happy places that contained both farms and bears. The Cherokee Indian Nation had had its pick of all the rivers of central Appalachia, and it chose the valley of the Little Tennessee as its home. There were hundreds of archaeological sites, some probably yet to be discovered. With its pretty white clapboard houses and its well-tended little farms, the valley was a beautiful anomaly, a place more at home in the 19th century. Tellico Dam would put all of this under 80 feet of water. After wrestling with its lack of a raison d'etre for a while, the TVA decided that the only way it could justify the new dam was to change the whole character of the region in which it would be. The solution, it finally decided, was to create an entirely new town around the reservoir, a chrome and steel headquarters for a major branch of the Boeing Corporation, which would go by the somewhat ironic name Timberlake. Actually, the TVA may have come up with the idea because the Bureau of Reclamation had thought of it first. In the 1960s, it was no secret that the Bureau, boxed out of much of its historical domain by the Corps of Engineers, was looking to expand its activities eastward. And Appalachia was the first place it planned to give things a try, building exactly the kind of sterile, reservoir-centered new towns of which Timberlake would be a first example. It was like deciding to put a 50,000-seat superdome in the middle of Wyoming and then building a city of 150,000 people around it to justify its existence. And there was no real guarantee by Boeing that it would establish itself there. It had merely expressed interest in the idea. But that was enough to get the project moving. By 1969, Tellico Dam was well on the way to being built. As it was going up, however, two entirely new hurdles were thrown in Tellico's path. One was the National Environmental Policy Act of 1969, which requires an environmental impact statement and a discussion of alternatives before any major federal project can proceed. The TVA claimed it was exempt from NEPA and had to be taken to court before it complied. The other hurdle, which no one paid much attention to at first, was the Endangered Species Act of 1973. In that same year, 1973, a professor of zoology from the University of Tennessee was snorkeling around in the Little Tennessee when a small fish, resembling a dace, darted out from under a rock in front of his face and gulped a snail. The zoologist, whose name was David Etnier, followed the fish until he could get a good look at it. He had never seen one like it before. After some taxonomic investigation, the fish was identified as a snail darter, a species that appeared to inhabit only a portion of the Little Tennessee, mainly the taking area of Tellico Dam. Its numbers estimated to be in the low thousands, its habitat apparently confined to one place, their daughter seemed eligible for classification as an endangered species. Before the act, that would have meant merely that the fish was probably doomed. Now it meant, by law, that protection of habitat critical to its continued existence was federal government's number one priority. The TVA tried to get around the act by attempting, without much success, to transplant the daughter to other nearby streams. Meanwhile, instead of suspending construction, it redoubled its efforts to complete the dam in a hurry, a time-honored strategy employed by the public works bureaucracies, but one which, this time, resulted in its being hauled into court by the Environmental Defense Fund. The Federal District Court essentially found for the EDF, but ruled that the Endangered Species Act was never intended by its framers to stop a project which was already 80% built. On appeal, however, the district court's decision was overturned, and completion of Tellico was stopped cold. The national media, which had covered the story with yawning lack of interest up to then, were suddenly tearing each other's clothes trying to get onto the Tellico site. Half the newspapers in the country seemed to run the story on page one, under some variation of the same headline. $100 million dam stopped by 3-inch fish. In most cases, the coverage went little deeper than that. Some editorial writers couldn't even see humor in the impasse. The Washington Star harrumphed that it was the sort of thing that could give environmentalists a bad name. Had the editorialists and reporters taken a longer look, they might have seen that the big story was not the dam at all, but the TVA itself, an agency that had evolved from a benevolent paternalism into the biggest power producer, biggest strip miner, and single biggest polluter in the United States. Unaccountable to the public, largely unaccountable to Congress, the TVA was an elephantine relic of the age of public works. It had undoubtedly done its region some good, but by the 1970s it had passed the uncharted point in an agency's career. 20 years, 30 years, sometimes much less, when it confronts new challenges with barnacled precepts and, in a sense, turns on the constituency it was created to help. Had they looked around them, the reporters might have seen that Appalachia, the godchild of this benevolent agency for 4 decades, still looked socially depressed. Physically, it looked horrifying. The single most important reason was the TVA's purchase of immense quantities of strip mined coal. It still clung to the discredited notion that the salvation of Appalachia lay in cheap power, and strip mine coal was the cheapest fuel. But the strip mining, besides eliminating thousands of jobs in deep mine coal, was creating a scene of gruesome devastation. The denuded mountains seemed covered with a reddish-brown rash, and rivers that were once pristine were running with what looked like old blood. Meanwhile, the TVA's older coal-fired power plants were creating pollution traps in the valleys where they were situated, and its newer ones, with smokestacks 1,000 feet high, were wafting sulfur and nitrogen oxides up to New York State and Canada, where they fell as acid rain. This same obsession with cheap electricity had, of course, resulted in the TVA's having built 30-odd major dams in the Tennessee Basin over the course of 30-odd years. The dams, mostly built during the Depression and the war era with low-interest money and by workers earning a few dollars a day, were the cheapest source of power around, and TVA's rates were as low as those in the Northwest. As in the Northwest, a complement of energy-intensive industries had moved in, aluminum, uranium enrichment, steel, and now the TVA was afraid they would move right back out if it raised its rates. It was a fear whose end result, rational or not, was the Tellico Dam. In June of 1978, the Supreme Court upheld the injunction against the dam on the basis of the Endangered Species Act, as written. Legally, the court had little choice, even though by then the dam was more than 90% built. Chief Justice Warren Burger, who wrote the decision, was clearly offended by the whole situation and all but invited Congress to amend the act. Congress required no such prompting. The legislative hopper began to spin with amendments to weaken or gut the act. Through the leadership of Senator John Culver of Iowa, however, and of Senator Howard Baker of Tennessee, whose only real interest was completing the dam, a less drastic amendment was passed, by which an Endangered Species Review Committee would be created to resolve any case where a major project such as Tellico ran up against the act. It was to be a cabinet-level committee composed of the Secretaries of Interior, Agriculture, and the Army, in addition to the administrators of the Environmental Protection Agency and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, and a representative from the affected state. According to the language of the amendment, the committee, which some began to call the God Squad, could grant exemptions to the act where no reasonable and prudent alternative exists, where the project is of national significance, or where the benefits of building it clearly outweigh any other course of action. The makeup of the interagency committee suggested a predisposition toward completing stalled projects, especially in the case of a dam. At best, Tellico's opponents were hoping for a 4-3 split in favor of construction, which might seem like enough of a hung jury to let them try another tack. They were wondering what such a tack might be when the committee's decision was announced. No one was prepared for the outcome. A unanimous decision that held for the snail darter and against the dam. In so doing, the committee skipped over metaphysics, transcendentalism, and evolutionary philosophy and ruled solely on the basis of economics. Tellico was a terrible investment, even worse, if the committee was to be believed, than the environmentalists had said. "Here is a project that is 95% complete," said Charles Schultz, the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, "and if one takes just the cost of finishing it against the benefits, it doesn't pay." Cecil Andrus added, "Frankly, I hate to see the snail darter get the credit for delaying a project that was so ill-conceived and uneconomic in the first place." God, in his new bureaucratic incarnation, had spoken. Tellico was a loser. It didn't deserve to be finished. The dam's two main congressional defenders, Senator Howard Baker and James Duncan, a Republican congressman whose district encompassed both the dam and the TVA's headquarters, still tried to blame everything on the snail darter. "Should a worthless, unsightly, minute, unedible minnow outweigh a possible injustice to human beings?" groused Duncan on the floor of the House, ignoring the injustice to the 1,000-odd people who would be evicted from their homes. Nonetheless, the finale had been written. Baker and Duncan had been beaten, fair and square, beaten through some oddly poetic reprise by Howard Baker's own amendment. The only thing for them to do was to accept defeat gracefully. June 18, 1979, was a dull day on the floor of the House, even duller than most. Little was going on, so hardly anyone was there. Bob Edgar was one of the many who were absent, and he still hates himself for it. He was one of the few congressmen who might have been suspicious enough to stop what was about to take place. "Duncan walked in, waving a piece of paper," Edgar recalls. "He said, 'Mr. Speaker, Mr. Speaker, I have an amendment to offer to the Public Works Appropriations Bill.'" Tom Bevel and John Myers of the Appropriations Committee both happened to be there. I wonder why. Bevel says, "I've seen the amendment. It's good." Myers says, "I've seen the amendment. It's a good one." And that was that. It was approved by voice vote. No one even knew what they were voting for. They were voting to exempt Tellico Dam from all laws. All laws. They punched a loophole big enough to shove $100 million dam through it, and then they scattered threats all through Congress so we couldn't muster the votes to shove it back out. I tried. Lots of people tried. But we couldn't get that rider out of the bill. The speeches I heard on the floor were the angriest I've heard in elective office. For once, a lot of my colleagues were properly outraged. Senator Baker and Representative Duncan couldn't have cared less. They got their dam. A few days later, The House passed the appropriations bill with a Telico rider still in it. The Senate followed suit, 48-44, despite two earlier votes against the dam. "That," said Edgar with sardonic disgust, "is a democratic process at work." There was, of course, still the possibility of a presidential veto. If anything, it seemed inevitable. Here in the case of one dam was everything that was rotten in Denmark. A bad project proposed by a dinosaurian bureaucracy, needless destruction of one of the last wild rivers in the East, usurpation of a quiet valley, and a cynical Congress sneaking around one of its own laws. Guy Martin and Cecil Andrus were both urging a veto in the strongest possible terms. Gus Speth, by then chairman of the Council on Environmental Quality, was privately talking of resignation if Carter backed down. Few in Carter's conservationist constituency even entertained the possibility that he wouldn't veto the bill. Congress, however, had taken care of everything. Carter was in the midst of negotiating a treaty that would give the Panama Canal back to Panama, and he was meeting stubborn resistance in Congress. The votes were lined up closely enough to put the president in a position of wretched vulnerability. The threats were quite naked. If Carter vetoed the bill, there would be no treaty. His education bill might suffer the same fate. In both cases, his embarrassment would be extreme, worse, perhaps, than if he swallowed the Telico exemption. The gulp was almost audible. On the night he signed the bill, the president telephoned Zygmunt Platter, the young law professor from the University of Tennessee who handled a case before the Supreme Court and performed a mea culpa. Platter was taken aback. He was, in fact, speechless, and he wasn't even sure why. Was it having the president on the other end of the phone, or was it the fact that a dam was now dictating foreign policy? When the gates closed on Telico Dam a year or so later, Carter's humiliation was just about complete. Not a vestige of his water policy reforms remained. Everything he had asked for was out. Everything he wanted out was in. Congress had made a mockery of one of its own laws, and even of an amendment weakening that law, for the sake of a water project so bad it made better sense to abandon than to finish it. The Telico vote was one of the things that prompted the normally restrained Elizabeth Drew, the New Yorker's Washington correspondent, to write a devastating series on Congress's capitulation to money and power. To those familiar with water projects, though, it was nothing new.
With the benefit of hindsight, some of Carter's own people are scathingly critical of how the administration handled the water projects issue. Guy Martin, his assistant interior secretary, is one. "He blundered from the word go," says Martin. "He might as well have gone up to the hill with a 6-pound codfish and slapped it across their faces. Andrus begged him not to come out with a big long hit list, but he did it anyway, and from that point on, the merits of the whole issue got lost. It became congressional prerogative, the imperial presidency. He was his own worst enemy. He had a great big chip on his shoulder about water projects. That was his problem. It made him focus way too much on the environmental issue, when the only way he could win was with the economic one. Most congressmen don't really care about wild rivers. The New Deal mentality is entrenched up there. Even the right-wingers believe in it. Carter loved wild rivers, and in the end, they thought he was just plain kooky." "What Carter could have done," Martin continued, "is pick the 3 or 4 worst projects instead of 19 or 32. That was another problem. He kept changing the numbers on them, and get rid of them. He could have done it. In war, you don't take 2 dozen beachheads on the same day. You can't, for God's sake. But he could have won some big ones. Auburn Dam, for instance. If that dam failed, it would be the worst peacetime disaster in American history. He had them there. Garrison and Oahe were awful. The farmers didn't even want Oahe. The Tug Fork project is so ridiculous, it strains belief. I can't help believing that if Carter had focused on a few, he could have eliminated them. Then he would have had a small victory, but a real one. Then there's next year." Having said all this, Martin added, almost apologetically, "Carter was right, though.
The projects are as bad as he said, most of them. The environmental damage is bad. The economics are bad. The politics are bad. The agencies are out of control. If the Corps and the Bureau built everything they wanted to, we'd hardly have any flowing water left. His instincts were good.
Many Western members of Congress, not to mention the water lobby and the bureaucracies, were overjoyed when Ronald Reagan was elected president after Jimmy Carter. Reagan might talk like a fiscal conservative, but surely he wouldn't be against water development. After all, he was a Westerner. He owned a ranch in dry country. His interior secretary, James Watt of Colorado, was the environmentalist's antichrist. Most of his other key domestic advisers were Westerners, too. James Baker, Ed Meese, William Clark, Paul Laxalt. All of them, and Reagan, too, certainly talked as if they believed in water development. No sooner had Reagan taken office, however, than his budget director, David Stockman, was talking about recovering 100% of the costs of new navigation projects from the beneficiaries, not just the capital costs, but the operating costs, too. In 1985, the Corps of Engineers spent around $1 billion on project operation and maintenance alone. There was also talk of forcing states to pay a large share of the costs of flood control dams, something Carter had never seriously proposed. Even Watt was suggesting that the states should contribute to reclamation projects up front. It wasn't exactly clear how large a share the administration had in mind, but privately, Watt was suggesting that 33% might be a reasonable amount. Since that would preclude practically all new water development, the water lobby didn't know quite how to react. Jan van Skilfgaarde, the director of Agriculture Department's Salinity Control Laboratory, was speaking one day with William Johnston, the assistant manager of the Westlands Water District in California, and he asked, "Why do you think Reagan is your friend if he wants you to pay a third of the fare? Carter only wanted 10%. As van Skilfgaarde recalls it, Johnston was silent for a moment and then said, "Well, Reagan understands us." "You can get cheaper understanding from a psychiatrist," was von Skilfgaarde's response. As expected, Reagan's original proposals were slowly nibbled away by Congress. But meanwhile, year after year, no new authorization bills managed to clear the floor, partly because the federal government was suffocating under its own mass, but also because Reagan, like Carter, was threatening to veto. In 1984, the entire $20 billion water projects authorization in the Public Works Bill, 300 projects worth, was taken out due to such a threat. A year later, when an almost identical bill reached the floor of the House, environmentalists, who had formed a discreet alliance with Stockman and other fiscal conservatives in the administration, had managed to sneak in amendments and conditions requiring local cost sharing on the order of 10% to 30%, even for flood control. If the amendments and conditions stayed in the bill, only a handful might get built. When a state sees that it has to put up $50 million toward construction of a dam, its enthusiasm is apt to wilt like a plucked blossom. As for the Bureau, one of its largest projects, Central Utah, had been burdened with a supplemental repayment contract that absolutely guarantees recovery of all costs before the CUP receives any further funding. That provision, which could stop the project dead in its tracks, also had Reagan's private blessing. No one could predict how much of this would remain in this or successive bills when they cleared Congress and reached the president's desk, and the Teleco experience led some to think not much. But the pork barrel seemed finally to have lost its anchorings and to be adrift on the very thing it helped produce, an uncontrollable tide of national debt. Chapter 10. Chinatown. Everyone knows there is a desert somewhere in California, but many people believe it is off in some remote corner of the state, the Mojave Desert, Palm Springs, the eastern side of the Sierra Nevada. But inhabited California, most of it, is by strict definition a semi-desert. Los Angeles is drier than Beirut. Sacramento is as dry as the Sahel. San Francisco is just slightly rainier than Chihuahua. About 65% of the state receives under 20 inches of precipitation a year. California, which fools visitors into believing it is lush, is a beautiful fraud. California is the only state in America with a truly seasonal rainfall pattern, stone dry for a good part of the year, wet during the rest. Arizona is much drier overall, but has two distinct rainy seasons. Nevada is the driest state, but rain may come at any time of year. If you had to choose among three places to try to grow a tomato relying on rainfall alone, South Dakota, West Texas, or California, you would be wise to choose South Dakota or West Texas because it rains in the summer there. California summers are mercilessly dry. In San Francisco, average rainfall in May is 0.4 inches. In June, 0.1 inches. In July, none. In August, none. In September, 0.5 inches. In October, 1 inch. Then it receives 18 inches between November and March, and for half the year looks splendidly green. The reason for all this is the Pacific High, one of the most bewildering and yet persistent meteorological phenomena on Earth, a huge immobile zone of high pressure that shoves virtually all precipitation toward the north until it begins slipping southward to Mexico in October, only to move back up the coast in late March. More than any other thing, the Pacific High has written the social and economic history of California. Actually, San Francisco looks green all year long, if one ignores the rain-starved hills that lie disturbingly behind its emerald and white summer splendor, but this is the second part of the fraud, the part perpetrated by man. There was not a single tree growing in San Francisco when the first Spanish arrived. It was too dry and wind-blown for trees to take hold. Today, Golden Gate Park looks as if Virginia had mated with Borneo, thanks to water brought nearly 200 miles by tunnel. The same applies to Bel Air, to Pacific Palisades, to the manicured lawns of La Jolla, where the water comes from three directions and from a quarter of a continent away. The whole state thrives, even survives, by moving water from where it is and presumably isn't needed, to where it isn't and presumably is needed. No other state has done as much to fructify its deserts, make over its flora and fauna, and rearrange the hydrology God gave it. No other place has put as many people where they probably have no business being. There is no place like it anywhere on Earth. 31 million people, more than the population of Canada, an economy richer than all but seven nations in the world, 1/3 of the table food grown in the United States, and none of it remotely conceivable within the pre-existing natural order. For all its seasonal drought, its huge southern deserts, and its climatic extremes, there is plenty of water in California for all the people who live there today. If, God forbid, another 25 million arrive, there will still be plenty for them. The only limiting factor will be energy. To get to where the people are likely to settle, a lot of the water has to be lifted over mountains. Take any 10 of the largest reservoirs, Shasta, Bullard's Bar, Pine Flat, Don Pedro, New Maloney's, Trinity, a few others, and you have enough water for the reasonable needs of 25 million people, enough for their homes, their schools, their offices, their industries, even, in all but the driest times, their swimming pools and lawns. As for the other 1,190 California dams and reservoirs, their purposes are threefold: power, flood control, and above all, water for irrigation. What few people, including some Californians, know is that agriculture uses 81% of all the water in this most populous and industrialized of states. California's $18 billion agricultural industry, and it is a gigantic, complex, integrated industry, is the largest and still the most important in the state, Silicon Valley notwithstanding. That figure, $15 billion, only begins to convey what agriculture really means to California. A great proportion of its freight traffic is agricultural produce. A disproportionate amount of the oil and gas mined in the state is used by agriculture. California agriculture supports a giant chemicals industry. It uses about 30% of all the pesticides produced in the United States. A giant agricultural implements industry, an unrivaled amount of export trade. Because it relies on irrigation, and therefore on dams, aqueducts, and canals, there is a close, symbiotic relationship with the construction industry, which is why politicians who lobby hard on behalf of new dams can count on great infusions of campaign cash from the likes of the Operating Engineers Local No. 3 and the AFL-CIO. And more than any other state, California has been a source of opportunities for the Bureau of Reclamation and the Corps of Engineers. All of this production, all of these jobs, all of these concentric rings of income-earning activity nourish California's awesome $485 billion GNP. It is a gross state product, obviously, but everyone seems to refer to it as the California GNP, as if the state were a nation unto itself, which it really is, and nowhere more so than in the example of water. California has preached and practiced water imperialism against its neighbor states in a manner that would have done Napoleon proud, and in the 1960s, it undertook by itself what was then the most expensive public works project in history. That project, the State Water Project, more than anything else, is the symbol of California's immense wealth, determination, and grandiose vision, a demonstration that it can take its rightful place in the company of nations rather than mere states. It has also offered one of the country's foremost examples of socialism for the rich. In the 1850s, when the California Gold Rush was at full flood, the Great Central Valley traversed by the miners on the way to the mother lode was an American Serengeti, a blonde grassland in the summertime, a vast flourishing marsh during the winter and spring. The wildlife, even after a century and a half of Spanish settlement, was unbelievable. Millions of wintering ducks, geese, and cranes, at least a million antelope and tule elk, thousands of grizzly bears. The winter of 1861 and 1862 was the beginning of the end for this scene of wild splendor. Relatively few of the 49ers found enough gold to pay their fare back home, let alone retire in the style of which they dreamed. California in the 1850s was full of broken men, searching for whatever day labor they could find. Many of them, having given up on returning home, decided to make a try at farming or ranching in the Central Valley. Most of the pioneers who followed the miners in wagon trains had farming on their minds too, and by the 1860s, the Central Valley was already a vista of cows. Because of the rainless summers, no important crop except wheat could be raised without irrigation, which was an alien form of agriculture to Americans. But the valley's chronic scarcity of moisture was suddenly reversed in 1861 and 1862. A series of vast, drenching Pacific storms bashed the state for weeks on end. In January of 1862, San Francisco recorded 27 inches of rain, half again what it usually gets in a year. The floods would have been bad anyway, but their destructiveness was greatly intensified by the incredible amount of spoil, whole sides of mountains, which hydraulic mining had sent down the rivers to the lowlands. The beds of the valley rivers were raised several feet and could not begin to contain the torrential runoff. Downtown Sacramento was under 7 feet of water. The 1862 flood marks the beginning of the valley's obsession with bringing the rivers under control. Meanwhile, farther south, in the San Joaquin Valley, Henry Miller was using the same flood to acquire hundreds of thousands of acres of ephemerally drowned lands under the Swamp and Overflow Act. Miller's acquisitive nature, combined with the serendipity, in his case, of the flood, made him enough money to construct a large dam, and he soon had his hundreds of thousands of acres under irrigation. Before he died, he was likely the richest farmer in the United States. When the valley ranchers saw how rich one could become through irrigation farming, they began to switch from cows and dry land wheat to crops. Few had Miller's ambition or wealth, however, and even when organized into irrigation districts, they couldn't duplicate his dam, so they irrigated with primitive sluiceways cut from the rivers, much as did the farmers along the Nile. As for the state and federal governments,
They wanted nothing to do with publicly financed irrigation projects, which were widely regarded as socialistic. Everything changed with the invention, shortly after World War I, of the centrifugal pump. Suddenly able to draw hundreds of gallons per minute out of the valley's shallow aquifer, the irrigation farmers no longer had to worry about building expensive canals, about cleaning them of silt. They no longer had to dream of regulating the rivers with dams to ensure summer flows. By the mid-1920s, thanks to irrigation pumping, California had surpassed Iowa as the richest agricultural state in the country. The Central Valley was the largest semi-continuous expanse of irrigated farmland in the world. The aquifer, which had collected over many thousands of years, was prodigious. Before pumping began, it may have held 750 million acre feet. With the expansion of irrigation farming from a few thousand to millions of acres, however, the water table began to drop sharply. By the end of the great drought of the 1930s, the farmers had so badly depauperated the groundwater that the depletion curves were precipitous. 20,000 acres had already lost their groundwater and gone out of production. Hundreds of thousands more overlay a groundwater table that was becoming dangerously low. Suddenly, the valley's reserve of groundwater, which had so recently seemed limitless, had only a few more decades of economic life. The farmers could look in two directions for help: Sacramento and Washington, D.C. The Bureau of Reclamation, which was just completing Hoover Dam, had such a hold on the public imagination and the Roosevelt administration that it could build almost anything it pleased. On the other hand, it was supposed to create new subsistence farms in the West, not rescue the farmers who were already there from the consequences of their short-sighted avarice. Besides, Hoover Dam had been a great gift to California, and the other Western states were waiting in line. Sacramento, then, was the better bet, even if it couldn't dip into the federal treasury to finance the farmers' rescue. In 1933, the state legislature succumbed to heavy lobbying from the growers, who had become its biggest source of campaign contributions, and passed the Central Valley Project Act. The legislation was a striking display of ambition for a single state, proposing as it did the control, through dams and reservoirs, of the largest and third largest rivers in California. The project bonds, however, could not be sold in the middle of the Depression, so the state was forced to let the Bureau of Reclamation take over the Central Valley Project. It was such a gargantuan scheme that the completion of its main features, including four big dams, required 18 years. The Central Valley Project was, without question, the most magnificent gift any group of American farmers had ever received. They couldn't have dreamed of building it themselves, and the cheap power and interest exemption constituted a subsidy that would be worth billions over the years. It is interesting, therefore, that originally many of the farmers hadn't wanted the Bureau to build the CVP. The wedding between the Bureau of Reclamation and the Central Valley farmers was never more than a marriage of convenience, and like many such marriages, it was soon on the rocks. As a starlet trades a virile but impecunious husband for a wealthy old tycoon, the farmers had, in effect, traded whatever hope they had of becoming agricultural grandees like Henry Miller for a secure supply of water. The Reclamation Act, which would apply in theory to the CVP, even though it only delivered supplemental water to most, required a farmer owning more than 160 acres of land, 320 for a man and wife, to sign recordable contracts to dispose of the excess holdings in order to continue receiving subsidized water. Since a great many farmers owned far more than that, the CVP looked as if it might become the first real land redistribution device in U.S. history. Leasing acreage above and beyond the 320-acre limit was also prohibited under the Act, and all excess holdings were supposed to be sold at their pre-project worth, which, in a valley where no crop could be raised without irrigation, was very little. On top of all this, the farmers receiving reclamation water were required to live on their land, not farm from Fresno or San Francisco, as many of them did. The Bureau stopped enforcing the residency provision in 1916,
but a federal court later determined that it was still valid. The whole idea was to keep speculators away and to open up arid land to as many new farmers as possible. "We weren't even supposed to give them 160 acres if they could make a living on less," says former Commissioner Floyd Dominey. "And in warm states like California, you could make a living on a lot less. We were talking about subsistence, nothing more." The CVP, in short, was fundamentally different from every earlier reclamation project. It did not create many new irrigated farms. It rescued thousands of farms that were already there, including a good many that were far larger than the law allowed. One of the farmers, whose land lay within the service area of the Central Valley Project, and who was scheduled ultimately to receive its water, was the DiGiorgio Corporation, whose lands grew more commercial tomatoes than any state except Florida. Another was the Southern Pacific, not a mere railroad, but the largest private landowner in California, and the eventual owner of 109,000 acres in the Westlands Water District, which was scheduled to become the largest single recipient of CVP water. The roster of landlords within the San Joaquin Valley was a who's who in corporate agriculture. Figures for 1946, published in a Senate report on the acreage limitation, reveal that Standard Oil owned 79,844 acres in the probable CVP service area, Will Gill and Sons owned 29,926 acres, the Belridge Oil Company owned 30,120 acres, the Tidewater Associated Oil Company owned 25,554 acres, the Richfield Oil Company owned 10,718 acres, the Anderson and Clayton Company owned 19,144 acres, and the J.G. Boswell Ranch Company, which, among others listed, was already receiving Kings River water virtually free, courtesy of the Army Corps of Engineers, owned 16,760 acres, part of a worldwide land empire later estimated at some 860,000 acres minimum. If such growers availed themselves of the Bureau's water, which they would doubtless want to do, the law was quite clear about the disposition of their cases. They would have to sell all lands in excess of 160, or more likely 320 acres, that received the subsidized water. The Reclamation Act's chief sponsor in the House, Frank Mondell, had said on introducing the bill that this divestiture provision was drawn with a view to breaking up any large landholding which might exist in the vicinity of government works. It was hard to imagine it stated more emphatically than that. The threat of divestiture gave the big growers in the CVP service area fits, even if the Bureau was far more interested in building more dams than in trying to enforce such an unpopular law, especially when the Interior Department's lawyers, few of whom were legal stars, had to go up against some of the craftiest legal talent in the state. One modest example of how the farmers managed to deceive the Bureau was provided by the case of Russell Giffen, one of the big landowners in the Westlands District. A Fresno rancher who stitched together 77,000 acres of valley property, about seven times the acreage of Manhattan Island, Giffen was the largest cotton grower in the world. Nationally, he also ranked just behind Boswell and one other farming company in the combined federal farm subsidies he received. In the 1970s, Giffen decided to clean up his estate for probate and sold most of the land for $32.5 million. One of the buyers was a New York-based company called Jubal Farms, in which a Bakersfield couple, William and Judith Rogers, owned an 80% interest. The Rogers, five other couples, most of them Rogers employees, the trusts of four Rogers children, and a mail-order denture company took title to 1,812 acres, all of it in parcels of 160 acres or less. All the new landowners then leased their property back to Jubal Farms. Financing for the whole deal, in the amount of $3.5 million, was provided by the Nishowawai American Corporation, the subsidiary of a Japanese conglomerate which happened to own the other 20% of Jubal Farms. On paper, and in the Bureau's recordable contracts file in Sacramento, the requirements of the Reclamation Act were satisfied. In reality,
The whole business was a translucent sham. One company, Jubal Farms, with its headquarters in New York City, was farming 11 times as much California land as the law allowed, with water it bought from the government for a few dollars per acre foot, probably one-tenth of its worth on the free market, had there been such a thing. But this phony transaction, cynical as it was at least a gesture of compliance with the Reclamation Act. Other farmers chose to stonewall the Bureau in court, moving into compliance a centimeter at a time. Any self-respecting lawyer could drag such a case out for years, while his client continued to receive subsidized water the whole time. Others were being granted special exemptions by the Interior Solicitor's Office. No one has ever produced hard evidence, but there has been speculation that such exemptions bore a more than casual relationship to the size of a campaign contribution, and these were growers who could easily contribute $50,000 to a candidate's coffer. Rita Singer was a lawyer in the Interior Solicitor's Office through the 1960s and early 1970s, until she resigned and joined the legal staff of California's Department of Water Resources. "We'd be working on a case for months," Singer recalled during an interview in 1984, "and then my supervisors would send down an interpretation of the law that nullified our cause of action. Some of the subterfuges would be allowed, others would be disallowed. There wasn't any rhyme or reason. In most cases, we never got an explanation. It was legal hair-splitting. The solicitor's office would recognize distinctions in cases that were identical. In effect, we were telling the growers, 'Go ahead, do whatever you want.' When we moved for enforcement, it was always inconsistent. We never gave them a serious message that we meant business." In public, Singer says, the growers cursed the Bureau, calling it dictatorial and using epithets far stronger than that. In private, they regarded the federal government as a laughingstock. The Bureau knew full well that numerous violations were taking place in California. In 1964, Interior Secretary Stuart Udall ordered Commissioner Floyd Dominey to investigate the number of violations occurring within the service area of the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California, presumably to use the information as a weapon to force the Met to drop its campaign of divide and delay against the Central Arizona Project. Dominey's regional director in Boulder City, R. Lee West, hired an investigator from Phoenix named Ralph O. Baird to conduct a surreptitious hunt for violators, learning what he could through deed records and word of mouth. According to a December 30, 1964, blue envelope memo sent to Dominey by West, extreme caution was required. Apparently, Baird thought he had some reason to fear for his safety. In 3 months, he managed to document 99 violations of the excess lands provision, totaling 105,229 acres. Several growers were irrigating thousands of acres with federally subsidized water wholesale to them by the Met. The largest of them was the Irvine Ranch, which in 1980 was the 11th largest landowner in California, with 28,257 acres of cropland, 82,344 acres all told, and $140 million in annual sales, according to the California Department of Corporations and Dun & Bradstreet. The list of violators has apparently been destroyed. Not a trace of it could be found in Dominey's files or bureau records in Boulder City. But West would admit in retirement that the violations had indeed occurred, that they might still be occurring, that in his estimation it was a clear-cut illegality under reclamation law, and that, for reasons he wasn't privy to, nothing was done. "I didn't even dare mail the list to Dominey," he said. "I hand-carried it to him on a plane. He looked it over and put it away. He told me never to talk about it, and he said it in that tone of voice of his that meant you'd better obey, and I never saw it again. There were some pretty powerful people on that list." In 82 years, the Bureau would see the breakup of only one major illegal landholding through to the end. That was the DiGiorgio Company, and it was stripped of its excess lands only because John Kennedy's Interior Department solicitor, Frank Barry, was relatively serious about enforcing the act. Later, when Jimmy Carter began making noises about enforcing the letter of the law again, The growers managed to lobby through, in 1982, the most extensive and, in the view of those who had watched in frustration as large growers evaded the Reclamation Act, not just for years but for decades, the least justifiable revision of the law in its 80-year history. The 160-acre limit was raised to 960 acres, and the leasing and residency restrictions were eliminated. In return, the growers are supposed to pay full cost for water delivered to all lands beyond the 960-acre limit. In 1987, however, the Reagan administration delivered an interior solicitor's opinion allowing subsidized water to be sold to unlimited 960-acre paper farms owned by relatives and trusts in the same family, the same fraud on a much larger scale that had gone on before the Reclamation Act was reformed. A Carter administration investigation conducted a couple of years earlier before the reform, the first serious effort to gauge the degree of compliance with the law, had established that more than 90% of the acreage violations were occurring in California and Arizona, whose hot climate permits high-value crops and two-crop seasons, exactly the kind of climate where the original 160-acre limit is eminently fair. In Colorado, or Montana, or Wyoming, where most farms are at altitudes of at least 4,000 feet, where the freeze danger period runs to 8 months, and where farmers are lucky to raise one good crop of low-value corn or wheat, a revision of the acreage limit was probably in order. But California's farmers, having received the gift of subsidized water not long before, were now awarded with a so-called reform whose chief result was to legalize wholesale noncompliance with federal law. Even if the farmer sensed that, ultimately, the government would cave in, the reclamation law was at the very least a nuisance to the big growers in the CVP service area. And to many of the really big growers who owned huge acreages toward the southern end of the valley, between Fresno and Bakersfield, the Central Valley Project meant nothing at all. Nearly all of its water deliveries stopped at Fresno, and most of it went to the valley's east side. The biggest donors were south of Fresno, and a number were on the west side, where they had amassed fiefdoms of dirt-cheap scrubland, which they were either irrigating or hoping to irrigate someday. Not a single substantial stream drains the lee side of the Coast Range south of San Francisco. Precipitation is barely 6 inches a year, so most of the west side growers were utterly dependent on groundwater. It was fossil water, water that had accumulated over hundreds of thousands of years, but which, at the rate it was being pumped, evaporated and transpired by plants, would barely last another 50, if that. The Central Valley Project was, in fact, to have an interesting, a startling effect on the groundwater table of the San Joaquin Valley. In Tulare County, at one test well, the aquifer dropped 60 feet between 1920 and 1960, the year the first CVP water arrived. Thanks to the flood of new surface water, the water table then rose 20 feet in 9 years. Just 3 years later, however, it had dropped another 33 feet. In Kern County, where the depth to groundwater is much greater, farmers who had pumped from 275 feet during World War II were pumping from 460 feet by 1965. The reason was obvious. The CVP and the Corps of Engineers projects on the Kings, the Kaweah, the Chulee, and the Kern had delivered a lot of surface water throughout the valley, but they had encouraged so much agricultural expansion that they hadn't really relieved the pressure on the aquifer at all. For a while, things were better. Then the projects actually made things worse. Half the agricultural water used in the state was still coming out of the ground. Even farmers who got cheap federal water continued to pump from their own wells in order to irrigate as much land as possible, and with three times as much irrigated land in production as there had been 30 years before, the big projects, besides depriving San Francisco Bay of half of its historical outflow, were just encouraging more pumping. If there were no controls over groundwater pumping, a lot of farming in the southern half of the San Joaquin Valley faced extinction. By the late 1950s, the land was producing the greatest agricultural bounty in the world. Four counties, Fresno County, Kings County, Kern County, Madera County, that were consistently among the six wealthiest agricultural counties in the nation, now looked as if they might topple like a row of dominoes. The farmers were like addicts, oblivious to their self-destructive ways. They were making so much money, they wouldn't think of groundwater regulation, and any politician who so much as uttered the phrase was instantly marked as a threat. A hand-picked Fresno legislator named Ken Matty once referred to groundwater regulation as World War III. The only answer, then, was to try once more to have the citizens of the nation's richest state build them a huge project to bring in more water from somewhere else. A Himalaya of obstacles, a series of seemingly insurmountable crests, stood between the San Joaquin Valley and its goal. Cities could afford to build dams and aqueducts because urban water was at least 10 times more valuable than irrigation water. And urban property was worth much more than agricultural land. The richest acre of valley land couldn't be traded for a 10-by-1,000 plot in Beverly Hills, so a big urban aqueduct would have billions in assessed valuation standing behind its bonds. But without the fabulous subsidies written into the Reclamation Act, the ability to pay clause, the exemption from interest, the hydropower profits shoveled right back to the farmers, few irrigation projects could be built anywhere. The only feasible ones were at perfect sites, where a first-class river with a first-class gunsight canyon lay right above some first-class irrigable land. If one had to build a huge dam on a middling river or an aqueduct hundreds of miles long, or if the water had to be pumped uphill, any non-federal project was out of the question. Unfortunately, the San Joaquin Valley had every one of those problems. Much of the land in need of rescue was second or third class, even fifth class, with vast depths to groundwater or drainage problems or alkaline deposits in the soil. Some of the barren acreage, held for speculative purposes by oil companies at the southern extremity of the valley, had no usable groundwater at all. The big rivers were all in the north, so an aqueduct hundreds of miles long would have to be built. And since the San Joaquin Valley slopes imperceptibly upward as one travels south, most of the land lay several hundred feet above sea level. The water would have to go to sea level in order to cross the delta in the middle of the state. Then it would have to be pumped 300 to 500 feet uphill. One thing was clear. The growers, rich as they were, could never finance such a project themselves, as cooperative irrigation districts had financed a few smaller projects on the east side. The state would have to build it. But California had become highly urbanized since World War II. The votes had shifted toward the cities on the coast. Those urban voters would be crucial in getting the project through the legislature. In fact, they would probably demand a public referendum, and a referendum cannot be bought as easily as an act of legislation. The urban voters would obviously have to subsidize the growers, too. Between the astronomical cost of building such a project and the cost of pumping the water uphill, the farmers could never afford it, not as long as CVP water was being sold to farmers next door for $3.50 an acre-foot, not as long as their cotton farming competitors in Georgia and Texas and Louisiana, cotton was the main crop in the southern San Joaquin, got their water free from the sky. And that meant only one thing. Urban Californians would have to get some of the water. If they didn't, they wouldn't vote for the project. Only one major city could logically be tied into the project, and that was Los Angeles. Water on its way from Northern California to Los Angeles would, of course, pass right through the San Joaquin Valley. With its meager and erratic rainfall, Los Angeles had always been haunted by drought. The thought of more water always set off a Pavlovian response. On the other hand, the metropolitan region didn't really need the water. The city of Los Angeles proper was getting virtually all its needs fulfilled by its Owens River Aqueduct, and its countless suburbs, together with San Diego, had recently gotten the first of their 550,000-acre-foot entitlement from the Colorado River. By the early 1950s, Los Angeles was extending its aqueduct into Mono Basin, where it planned to divert the streams tumbling out of Yosemite that feed Mono Lake. Meanwhile, the Metropolitan Water District, the area-wide water imperium serving most of Southern California, was already planning a second aqueduct to the Colorado River, which would double that supply. This was water that Southern California planned to borrow from Arizona's entitlement for as long as Arizona, stymied by Southern California's congressional delegation, was unable to build the Central Arizona Project. 6 million new people could settle in